All right, switching gears. Switching gears. How many of you even remember the Red Letter Study? It has been a long time. We started the Red Letter Study sometime last year. And if you're not familiar with what we're talking about, the Red Letter Study is going through just the actual words of Jesus in the Gospels that are sometimes printed in red ink in some editions of the Bible. So we've been going through that. But when we started with Lent, we took a break because we really wanted to treat Lent differently, and then there was Easter, and then there was something else after Easter, and so I'd like to get back to the Red Letter Study, and I don't know if any of you recall where we are, but we're right in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount, almost literally in the middle, right in the middle of chapter 6. So the Sermon on the Mount is Matthew 5, 6, and 7. We're in the middle of chapter 6, and I wanted to start with a thought for you all. What would you say is the most damaging attitude that you can have toward the spiritual life, toward life in general, I suppose, but especially toward the spiritual life and spiritual formation, the spiritual journey? What would be the most damaging attitude that you can have?
Pride.
Hatred, pride,
indifference.
Resentfulness,
fear.
All really good answers. But not the one that I was going for. which is not surprising. For my money, what I would say is that passivity is the most damaging attitude. It incorporates so much of what you just threw out. But passivity, that lack of energy, that lack of will, that non-active, non-participating part of ourselves, you know, that non-action or non-even response, non-resistance to anything, just kind of going along. Anybody who is passive in life or passive in their spirituality isn't going to be making much progress. And that, I think, is the most difficult thing. And you've probably heard me say it before. I think one of the most damaging things that the church has done in interpreting Jesus' message, for my money, incorrectly, has been to make us into a passive people. Everything is done by Jesus. We just come under the blood covering and nothing else has to be done. There is no sense of that there is actual work for us to do, that there isn't something for us to actually work for. And that passivity has hurt us deeply in terms of being able to actually do what Jesus was tasking us with doing, which was doing what he did himself, actually following this way. Which I keep going back to, the first followers of Jesus, calling themselves followers of the way, Talmidei Urcha in Aramaic, is so instructive for us. They weren't even followers of Jesus, they were followers of the way. Yes, Jesus was identified with the way, but they knew that they needed to do something. It's not passive. Now, we spend so much time in here talking about contemplative practice, and I know some of you are thinking, and because we've talked about this before, that contemplation to you seems passive. It seems like you're just letting everything go, stepping aside from everything and not really engaging. But I would like you to rethink that. Because true contemplation is nothing like passivity. True contemplation is a clearing out of everything that would distract you or limit you from being able to take action in love. See, that's the difference. The action that we take, is it in love or is it in fear? Because if it's in fear, we're just more part of the problem. We're never a part of the solution. But when we can act in love, then we can start to make a difference in the way that Jesus made a difference in his community. Contemplation is the active clearing of that space. From the outside looking in, yeah, it may look passive, but from the inside out, it takes everything that you've got. And so I wanted to clear that up. We have passivity creeping into our culture and creeping into our mindset, our worldview, our religions all over the place. You know, just in the way that we pray. Imagine that you're sitting next to a pool. It's a hot day and you're praying for God to cool you off. God, please cool me off. In fact, God, if you will cool me off, I will give up swimming until you cool me off. You see what's happening here? Bargaining as prayer, And especially when we're bargaining away the very thing that we need to do in order to affect the change that we're praying for, is passive manipulation of God. At least that's what we're trying to do. It doesn't work, but that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to manipulate God passively. And the irony is that God has already acted. God has acted from the beginning of time as we know it in this time-space bubble, in this universe. There is nothing left for God to do. He has done everything that he can to create this nest for us and to give us everything that we need in order to be able to return to him as he created us to be able to do. God has already acted. Now, it's our turn. What are we going to do with our turn? Are we even going to realize that we have a turn? This is the problem that we are facing. Because many of us won't face life directly. Many of us won't face our trials directly. And we often hide behind our religion. God, please do this. Do that. We look to God to do the things that we need to be doing for ourselves in God's empowerment. And we hide behind our spirituality. We over-spiritualize things so that it seems to absolve of us of the responsibility to act for ourselves. And if you really think about it, this is passive aggression, isn't it? Do you know what the common signs of passive aggression are? Stick with me. I'm going to tell you. These certain behaviors can help us identify passive-aggressive behavior in others. First of all, a person who's passive-aggressive does not express hostility or anger openly. They're not going to do that. They might leave you a note, but they're not going to express it openly. Passive-aggressive person is characterized by ambiguity. They're a master of mixed messages. They're a master at fence sitting. They always are retaining their options, always retaining their sense of control. They're always blaming others, complaining. They can't take responsibility for their own failings. How about chronic lateness and forgetfulness? Setting up rules but avoiding obligation, right? Fear of authority, fear of competition, feeling inadequate. They can end up being the wimp or the tyrant, but it's all coming from the same place. There's a fear of dependency. They're unsure of their own autonomy. They're always trying to control situations. There's a fear of intimacy, mistrustfulness, afraid of being revealed, to let people know who they really are. Sometimes they pick fights to create the distance, create the chaos in order to not have to work at a particular relationship, perhaps, or something. Use infidelity as a means to act out their anger. Again, always coming in from the side, never direct. They will foster chaos. Sometimes they'll leave puzzles incomplete, leave jobs undone. Intentional inefficiency. I always remember Bill Cosby saying that he saw the boss's job, his wife's, and he didn't want it. And so he just pretend like he didn't know how to do stuff so that he would never be called on to do it, the kind of thing we're talking about here. Making excuses, losing things, create reasons for not fulfilling promises, lying, withholding information in order to hold on to power. Obstructionism, procrastination, won't settle on deadlines, work slowly. Deadlines don't really exist in their mind, and they avoid responsibility. Resisting suggestions from others. Resentment, sarcasm, stubbornness, sullenness. If you take a look at that whole list, what you see is a person who is unwilling to deal with life and with issues directly. Deeply, they feel the fear of inadequacy, and so they won't deal with things directly. They come at it from the sides. But they are also feeling all of this bitterness and resentment and fear. And so it comes out in all these ways. And if you think about it, all these traits that I've talked about are also the traits of the victim. They're traits of victim mentality. What is a victim anyway? And if you really come down to the best definition that I can come up with for a victim, and there's lots of them that'll be chipping away at it, but the one to me that is the most salient is that a victim has no choice. A victim has no choice. Whatever has happened to the victim happened without their consent, and there was nothing that they could do about it. But the thing is, once you get your choice back, are you going to take your personhood back? Or are you going to hang on to your victimhood? Because a victim, of course, is not responsible by definition. If there's no choice, then there's no sin. If there's no choice, there's no responsibility. The person didn't fail. They had no choice in the matter. This was done to them. A victim must be saved. A victim needs a savior because a victim has no choice to make of his or her own in their life, in their moments. And this is why that victim role is so seductive. People will stay in victim mentality for decades, for the rest of their lives sometimes. It's like a warm blanket that you can put around you because you don't have the responsibility. You don't even have the choice to make changes. You don't have to do anything. You can remain passive as long as you are a victim, as long as you see yourself as a victim. But the truth of the matter is we're only victims momentarily. You're walking down the street and the van pulls up and the masked guys come out, grab you, hug tie you, and throw you in the van. You're a victim. But as soon as you get a hand free, you've got a choice. No longer a victim. And obviously, the smartest thing might be pretend that you're still tied up. But you get my point. Once you have a choice again, you're not a victim any longer. And yet, we remain victim for all of these reasons. There's no responsibility to act. And passivity is now acceptable. It's not only acceptable, but it's the only choice you have because you got no choices. And you can blame whoever you want to blame. You can blame the devil for this. We do all the time in Christian circles. You can blame life itself. You can blame your parents, your church, your God, your government, whoever you want to blame for the situation that you find yourself. All those perpetrators out there, whether direct or indirect. And this is what we see happening in our culture. I mean, just look at the political dialogue here. It is all about blame. Everywhere we look, it's all about these traits here. Who is actually trying to hit issues on the head, hit nails on the head, actually work through problems? It's not there. It's all about retaining power and retaining control because of the interior fear that has not been resolved in the person. And the victim, of course, is innocent of all their failings. And that probably is one of the most seductive things. But you know what? We weren't created to be innocent. Did you ever think about that? We're not here to be innocent. We're not here to stay innocent. We're born that way. But we're not here to stay. You know, the Garden of Eden, we always look back at the Garden of Eden as been the ideal state of human beings, to be able to walk with God in the cool of the evening and not know that we're naked and have that kind of one. That's not the ideal state. That's a state of immaturity. That's the state of the child. That's the state of a human being who has not yet gotten to the age where they can see and understand moral choices, see right from wrong, or even have the ability to make a choice at all. That's what the story is all about, of eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It is the coming of age. It is the necessary coming of age. Because the part of us that is created in God's image is our ability to choose. Animals don't really have that. Small children don't have that. We have that. That's the part of us that's created in God's image. Why do we have that? Why do we have this free agency, free will? Because love without a free choice is not love. If God created us to love as he loves, then he had to give us the ability to choose freely so that when we chose love, it was really love and not coerced in any other way. The Garden of Eden was not an ideal state of innocence. It was just immaturity. It was non-volitional. And if you think about it, weren't Adam and Eve still kind of victims at that point? They didn't have the choice. They were created the way they were created. Until they ate from the tree, they had no choice. Small children, aren't they really victims of whatever the parents and the family have to offer them? They don't have any choice in the matter. Completely non-volitional at that point. We're not meant to be innocent. We're not meant to stay innocent. Until the age of reason, then the choice changes everything. We're meant to live this life to the full. We're meant to get our uniforms dirty. We're meant to get all wrinkly and pruny at the end. And as one person said, our last check should go to the undertaker and it should bounce. I remember when I was playing football in high school, you know, I was a bench rider. What can I tell you? I don't know if I ever got into an actual game, but I was at all the workouts and I was at all the practices. And there is nothing more humiliating than running off with the team at the end of a game in a uniform that is so bright white and clean that it practically glows in the dark. So we bench warmers, what we learned to do is during the exercises out on the grass before the game, we would scuff our knees and get as dirty as we could. So at least we had the credibility of maybe having gotten in for a play or two. We're meant to get our uniforms dirty. We're meant to get all used up. We're meant to get hurt. We're meant to get wounded. This is what life is really all about. If we're trying to avoid it, we're avoiding exactly what life is all about. That's what the hero's journey is all about. The hero's journey is always motivated by a wounding, motivated by some hurt, some loss, some trauma. That's what kicks us into the journey in the first place. And it's only through the succession of these journeys that we actually get anywhere in terms of our spiritual formation. This is what this is all about. If you think about it, a victim is the opposite of what God created us to be. Because he created us with choice. He created us to learn from our mistakes, to own them, and then to chart new courses. He created us to be free. And one thing a victim with no choice is not, is free. A victim is the opposite of all of this. What we're here to do is to actually learn to choose for others, despite the loss of our innocence. Despite the loss of our certainty that we had before we lost our innocence, and despite the fear that we have as fragile creatures trying to live this life with a death sentence hanging over our head, right? When it comes to the church and what the church has taught us, legalism, this belief that somehow the law or obedience to the law saves us, that idea of legalism, obedience itself, conformance without question, is passive. Really think about that. Just obeying the law without question is passive. It's a passive response. Without any kind of questioning, without any kind of resistance for things that shouldn't be, it's passive. What Jesus is showing us in his teaching and what he's showing us right here in chapter 6 and chapter 5 is a non-passive and active way of living life, of living this way back to God. It's active. It's not passive. In chapter 5, he showed us how to deal with the law. We deal with the law in a passive way, just blind obedience, right? And why is that? Because we fear punishment. But what does 1 John tell us? You know, perfect love casts out fear. If someone's walking around in fear, then they're not perfected in love, because fear is the fear of punishment. We're going to have to do 1 John 4 at some point, because it's all right there in a beautiful way, very clear. So if we are dealing with the law just out of blind obedience, that is passive. What Jesus is telling us is that if you think because you haven't murdered someone that you're doing just fine in God's graces, well, then I'm here to tell you that even if you have an angry thought against them, you're already guilty before the court. Why would that be? Because your feelings, your thoughts, the quality of your relationships are your choices. It's your responsibility. Even if you're good under the law, those damaged relationships are yours to change, yours to fix. And in those damaged relationships is the definition that you are no longer residing in kingdom. Kingdom is the bringing together of all of that. He's showing us there is an active way to follow the law. And it's following it from the inside out until it's written on your heart. And then you're not even obeying anymore. It is just your pleasure to follow the law. If there is one out there someplace, it's the disappearing law. As soon as it's written on your heart, you don't need it anymore. This is the way you deal with law in an active way. In this chapter, chapter 6, he's telling us and showing us how we handle righteousness in exactly the same way. The kingdom is active. We can't be a victim in kingdom. How do we now handle righteousness in an active and not a passive way? Let's just review really quickly. Go back to Matthew 6 at verse 2. I know it's been a few months since we hit this. Jesus is saying, remember, there are three ways that the Jews of Jesus' time measured their righteousness. It was by giving alms, giving charity, right? It was by prayer and fasting. Those were the three ways that they measured their righteousness before men and before God. Jesus is going to hit each one of these in a series and redefine them the same way that he redefined the law. He says, so when you give to the poor, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets so that they may be honored by men. Truly, I say to you, they have the reward in full. Now, the context for that is that the Pharisees and rich people, they would go in and the trumpet was the collection bins in the court of the temple, and they would bounce their coins off so that it made a huge sound and everybody would look and say, wow, they gave a lot of dough right there, right? In other words, they're telegraphing everything that they've done. And so following righteousness and the rules or the customs of righteousness in a passive way was to meet their own needs, their own social aggrandizement, their own social status, right? It's what they were looking to achieve. And Jesus saying, that is just a passive-aggressive way of dealing with what you consider your righteousness. Now, to bring it into maybe a little bit more of a context for us, you know, we kind of look sometimes at giving in a superstitious way. You know, if I give to the church, if I give to God, then you can't outgive God. So if I tithe, then God's going to make sure my mortgage is paid. If I tithe, then all this is going to go well. That kind of spiritual rabbit's foot that we want to carry around. That also is passive aggressive. It's passive. It is not active in terms of what giving is supposed to be all about. Jesus is talking about if we actively identify with the other, and in this case, a person in need, if we actively identify with them, if we recognize in them our own mutual dependence, maybe we at the moment are doing okay and they're not, but we recognize in them our mutual dependence, our mutual vulnerability. And our response is just automatic. They need something that we can give, and we just do it without really thinking about it, certainly without thinking about telling people about it and not thinking about what God's going to give me down the road. It's just a connection that we can have. That's an active way to go about the righteousness of giving. If you think about giving money, it's kind of passive, isn't it? You just give money, but it doesn't really, yeah, take some numbers out of your account. But if you give time, time is active. It really takes something directly from you, and you have to be present in order to do it. You can give money halfway around the globe. You'll never see it. You'll never see what it does. But giving time, your personal presence, is different. And obviously we need both. And you can also think about money as time credits. Have you ever thought about money as a time credit? It really is, right? You give your time to somebody and they give you a credit for the time that you gave to them. And then you give this time credit to somebody else who then gives you a product that is the product of their time and their energy. All we're doing is really passing our time around, if you think about it. But we need to be able to do it with this idea of real identification with people. Because if we are trying to separate ourselves from the actual connection, what's that all about? When I started working with a nonprofit 30-some years ago, I always remember the founder of the nonprofit saying that often he would go to these fundraisers and these parties for fundraisers, right? And he would meet people who would just lavish their praise on him. I'm so glad you're doing what you're doing. You know, it's beautiful what you're doing. And, you know, I want to support what you're doing because I couldn't do what you're doing. And he turned and he was saying to me, you know, that's just a cop-out. Everybody can do what I'm doing. Maybe not where I'm doing it, but doing it someplace. And he saw these people as deferring onto him the kind of connection and the kind of active energy that they should be expending somewhere. But they're kind of making him into a positive scapegoat, if you will. Let's put it all on him. He will go do. I think it's kind of like carbon credits, you know, same sort of idea. I'm not going to stop my energy use, but I'm going to buy this carbon credit over here, so I'm going to be covered, right? Again, a passive way, a legalistic way of trying to deal with stuff. Look at Matthew 6:5, when he talks about prayer. When you pray, you are not to be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners so that they may be seen by men. Same idea as before. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward in full. Again, he's trying to tell us prayer is not a way for us to manipulate our circumstances. We can't just pray and somehow expect things to change. Sometimes you just got to jump in the pool if you want to get cool. You don't have to sit there and wait for God to cool you. Just jump in the pool. Prayer to Jesus is an active means of coming at God, an active means of knowing God, experiencing God, and thereby being able to thrive in all circumstances, or at least to be content in all circumstances. As Paul says at the end of his life, he finally learned how to do that because he was not so good at it in the earlier letters. Read Galatians. He's an angry man in Galatians. But by the time he gets to Philippians, different story. He has learned to be content. Prayer can do that for us if we are approaching prayer not as a passive manipulation, but as an active means of coming at God. At Matthew 6:16, whenever you fast, do not put on a gloomy face as the hypocrites do, for they neglect their appearance so that they will be noticed by men when they are fasting. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. Same formula, right? Fasting is not a passive elimination of the negative. It's not eliminating some vice that you have. And it's not just doing penance for your sin, also in a passive way. Fasting, if it's done correctly, is an active means of focusing both the mind and the body into the present, right? Into presence, God's presence. It helps and works hand in glove with our prayer and also with our giving. All three of these are geared to do the same thing, to bring us into the present, to connect us right here. Because we can't live our lives as a negative. You can't just go through trying to pull out everything that you don't want. All you're doing is creating an interior vacuum that's going to suck the next thing in. Jesus talked about that with the person who was exorcised from a demon but didn't do anything else. The exorcism was done for him, to him. He was passive in that. And I love the image of the spirit moving through the waterless places after it's forced out of the man's body. But then he comes back and sees the house all swept and clean. In other words, nothing has been replaced. No work has been done. So he moves right back in and brings seven of his friends. And the guy's situation is worse than it was at the beginning. We can't live our lives as a negative. We need to actually go after the positive things that we want in life. Go after presence. I kid you not, 90% of the spiritual life is just presence. Just the practice of presence. Just do that. Forget about the rest. Just practice presence and you will get there. That is what infills. That is what dissipates all the things that we don't want. Jesus' way, this way of Jesus that we're talking about, is really all about laying down the role of the victim, laying down the role of the passive aggressive. But the victim probably brings it home because all those past hurts, all of those traumas are what Jesus' way will get us past. He's like the greatest and original divine therapist. He will get us through all of this as we move through this way of Jesus. What do you think and we talked about this just a few days ago, what the cross is all about? You know, was Jesus a victim on the cross? When you think about it, yeah, he was technically, you know. He was bound, he was beaten, he was made to do everything that he did in those last excruciating hours of his life. But on the other hand, He made conscious choices every single step of the way. Nothing happened that he didn't assent to. He chose to keep on because he knew that the cross would be the ultimate expression of this love, this absolutely indiscriminate and degreeless love. And without that, he would have compromised his whole life's message. He assented. He was no more a victim than anyone who was perpetrating on him because he made choices all along the way, exercising those choices. And he's telling us that we need to do exactly the same thing, to realize that we have the choice to actually partner with God. What happened to Gethsemane when he said, "Not my will, but your will be done"? He was partnering with God, even though he knew the path that it was going to lead him down. We have that same choice. We can partner with God. You know, I said this one time and someone really got offended when I said that. And they just said, "Oh, that's arrogant presumption of you to say that you can partner with God." And I get that. I understand that. But this is exactly what Jesus is telling us, isn't it? What does he mean when he says, "These things that you see me do, you will do, and greater things than these, if you follow my way, if you abide in my word," which is saying exactly the same thing. You can actually move with God. Did you know there are two words for kingdom in the Bible? The first one that we run across is mamlacha. And that refers to all the bad kingdoms, the evil kingdoms. The kingdom of Saul, the first king, is referred to as mamlacha, the kingdom of Saul. All of the Gentile kingdoms and all of the evil kings of Israel, once they had a monarchy, those were all mamlacha. Mamlacha refers to a one-way dictatorial despotic rule. It is the king dictating to the people what they must do on pain of death, on pain of suffering, and everything that the law has under his command. And so, by definition, the people are passive. They obey or they die. You know, maybe they're making some choices. Maybe there's some resistance here and there. They're trying to be active. But mamlacha is that type of rule. And it necessitates a passive populace. As contrasted with Malkutha. Malkutha is the word that Jesus uses when he talks about kingdom. Malkutha is the word that's used when David's kingdom is talked about and the good kings of Israel are talked about. Because Malkutha really means the principles by which the king reigns. It is the principles that the king imbues and gives to the people. And the people become the king's hands and feet. They actually act out the will of the king. It is active. The people are in partnership with the king. It is their pleasure to do so because the king obviously has the people's best interests at heart, and they know that. And they work together to create this kingdom. That's exactly what Jesus is saying in the first line of the Lord's Prayer. "Your kingdom come, your will be done, as in heaven, so on earth." It's that we are God's hands and feet. We are the enactors of this kingdom. We are the enactors of God's will on this earth. This is what he's talking about. The Jews understood people, human beings, to be living between heaven and earth, between Shemaiah and Ara. And the idea was Shemaiah is the place of oneness and all connection and God's domain, and earth is a place of individual form and function and diversity and everything that we see, all the dizzy and contradiction and complexity that we see. But our job as human beings was to bring heaven to earth and earth to heaven, in other words, to merge the two, which Jesus means when he says, "Until heaven and earth pass away, the law will continue." But until they merge and become one in our hearts, then we don't need the law anymore. If that ever happened at the community level, we wouldn't need the law anymore in the group setting either. This is how we partner with God. This is what partnering with God actually means. In full humility still, of course. In full recognition of our vulnerability and our dependence, of course. Just as Jesus lived his life, humble, vulnerable. We choose to live and love as God lives and loves. And to enact that here. We are his sons and daughters standing in his place, his avatars, if you will, on this earth. living out that love. Partners, active, never passive, and of course, never victimized. So when Jesus moves on from where he's been, and now we're moving into some new territory here in verse 6, or chapter 6, and he starts talking about storing up treasures. Look what he says at verse 19. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So this little passage at once is summing up all the teachings that preceded it. Right? He went through everything, and now this is like the moral of the story, if you will. Right? Store up treasures in heaven, not on earth. Because where your heart, your treasure is, your heart is as well. It's also introducing the next section that we're going to be talking about as we move forward. And so what we need to understand to really get where Jesus is going with this, ancient Eastern wealth was measured by fine clothing, especially fine silks, food stores, whether it happened to be grain or oil or wine or livestock, precious metals, jewels, land. In other words, wealth to the ancients was not about a bank account with a lot of zeros in it. It was all about real property, about real assets that had some value. That was what wealth was all about to the ancients. Now, even if we say that that we have our treasure in heaven, for us, it has a different connotation. What we need to do is kind of go back and understand how this works. Jesus is giving his people very concrete images to work with. They understood exactly what he meant when he used the imagery in this passage, because they understood the way that wealth was measured, right? But at the same time, those fine silks, that fine fabric, was prone to moths. Moths love that stuff. It came from moths in the first place, right? They're just returning to the moths, as it should be. Rust, the word is ekal in Aramaic. It literally means to eat or consume or to devour, and that's what rust does to metals. And then you've got mildew that would rot away your grain. You've got vermin that would eat away your grain. You've got thieves that would break in and steal. And remembering that most of the houses were just sun-hardened mud bricks, what's a kind of like adobe would be to us, right? It wasn't much of a stretch to just cut a hole, dig a hole out in the wall, come in and break in and steal. All of these are very concrete images to these people. The heart that he talks about, where your treasure is, your heart is as well. Leba in Aramaic. Just like eye, when we talked about eye just a couple of weeks ago, you know, if your eye is clear, then your whole body will be full of light. Aina in Aramaic doesn't just mean physical eye. It means basically your whole worldview. It's the way you see. It's the way that you understand the world around you. Well, heart, in a very similar way, doesn't just mean the organ. It's the center of your courage. It's the center of your intelligence, your feelings, your passion. It's the whole breast and mind. It's the pith. It's the marrow. It's the center, and the best part of anything is the heart. We use it in the same way figuratively, right? That's what Leba meant to the people. And so the heart, if you look at it that way, literally means the person's whole principles. It's their guiding philosophy. What animates them? What informs their choices? That would all be about the heart. And you can kind of see as we expand on that meaning where Jesus is going with this, what are our guiding principles? Who's really driving the bus of your life? What are the principles by which you choose and move forward? Jesus is saying, if mammon or mammona, the original word that mammon comes from in the Greek, is your guiding principle, then where's your focus going to be? Well, your focus is going to be on material needs, obviously. Because what is mammon? Mammon is what you pile up in your life that eventually comes to define you. It's not just having wealth. That is not your mammon. Your mammon is what you're obsessing over. Your mammon is what you rely on. Your mammon is what you cling to. It doesn't even have to be. It could be a person. It could be your looks. It could be your intelligence, your talent. It could be anything. Whatever it is that you have glommed onto to manipulate circumstances, to get where you need to go, to deal with competition, to meet your physical needs, to survive, that is what has come to define you. And that's what Jesus is talking about. If that is your heart, if that is your guiding principle, whatever that happens to be, then your focus is going to be outward. It's going to be on material needs. It's going to be on the continued control that you need to exercise over everything and every situation that you come across. And of course, it's going to be fear-based. And that is active. That is active. And if that is active, then guess what's passive? It's your sense of spirituality. That has become passive because all your focus is here on these physical needs and on this control, all driven by fear. Now, we may say, yeah, but I have my treasure in heaven. I believe, you know, I've got my treasure in heaven. But we got to be careful here because for us as modern Christians, when we talk about heaven, what are we talking about? We're talking about some abode in the afterlife. So for us, if we say our treasure is stored up in heaven, we're still focused, not here, but somewhere out there. And what does that do? It makes us passive again here because everything is deferred. This is just the place we got to suffer and mess around for a while. You know, as long as I'm covered by the blood, then I'm going to be okay in the next life. That's where my treasure is stored, not here. And so we become passive all over again. But in Aramaic, heaven is Shemaiah. Shemaiah was used as a euphemism for God's name because you didn't speak God's name. And so Shemaiah was what you would use, or Adonai, or Hashem, the name, Adonai, Lord, Shemaiah, heaven. We would use all of those euphemisms so that you didn't actually say God's name, but it is identified and identical with God, with Alaha, the Aramaic word for God, which means unity, oneness. And guess what? All of that is here now. All of that is active. If our treasure is stored up in heaven, it's not the heaven of next life. It's right here, right now, in the presence, in the connection, in the relationships that we have and can grow here as we move into kingdom. Again, this living between heaven and earth, between Shemaiah and Ara, merging the two to become one with and partner with God's presence, with God's will. And his will, Sebiana, is his pleasure, delight, and deepest purpose. If we drop our desire, delight, and deepest purpose into the same place where God's is, that is the unity. That is the oneness. That is the presence of kingdom. And that's what Jesus is talking about. Store up your treasure in Shemaiah, in oneness, in unity, in presence, right here and now. Never there then. There then does not exist. The past does not exist. The future does not exist. The only thing that exists is this moment we're having right here and right now. If we're not here, we're nowhere. This is it. If you don't experience it here, you're not going to experience it anywhere else. Of course, you walk out that door and it's another here now, right? It's always here now. And this takes us right back to the present, right back to presence with a capital P. The kingdom is always here and now, and it can't be anywhere or anywhere else. It is always right here. But guess what? A victim is never present. I want you to think about that for just a second. A victim is never present. A victim is always reliving the past because that is a central focus. That is what they are clinging to in order to maintain the victimhood. They are always reliving the past or they are imagining the future. And of course, they're fearing the future. But they're never here and they're never now. They believe they have no choice in the present. And so they've got no life here in the present. They are passive. Everything about them is deferred. Now, we're all on a spectrum here. It's not hard left and right, on or off, black or white. But I think it is a good exercise for us to take a look at ourselves, be ruthlessly honest as we look at ourselves. Where are we on this spectrum? How present can we be? How present does our fear allow us to be? How passive-aggressive are we? Because this is all going to give us an indication of where we are in our spiritual journeys, where we are along Jesus' way. Jesus' way is to know the truth. And the truth will make us free. What is the truth? Well, the truth is we have this love that can't be lost because it can't be gained. But because of that, the truth is that we are not victims. We can choose to be partners with God. We can choose to be active partners with God. And how do we know the truth? How do we go about doing this? Thomas Keating was brilliant at this. His book helped me so much, Invitation to Love. But what he said is that this spiritual journey does not need to be felt, but it does need to be practiced. We put so much on emotion. We put so much on feeling this or feeling that. That's not the important part. The important part is just showing up. Are you willing to practice this? This is the essence of Jesus' contemplative way. Are we going to practice this? Are we going to show up for it? We have to practice presence. We're getting back to Brother Lawrence now, right? We have to practice the presence of God. We got to set our own structure. We got to set our and be disciplined to whatever structure we set for ourselves. It doesn't matter what it is, you know, how high or how low you set the bar. But if there is something that you will do and continue to do and keep showing up doing regardless of how you feel about it, if you will become more intentional about living your daily activities with a sense of presence and connection, not just with unseen God, but with each other as well. And with the task at hand, whatever it is that you're doing, to consciously be aware, not thinking about it, but consciously aware of the connection that you're having. And the joy that that brings, a sense of fulfillment, meaning, and purpose it brings, just to be working hard and aware of the connection that brings you with the people who are going to be touched by your work, the things that you do. Are we going to finally start to experience God's presence, connection in these moments that we have? Yes, if we are intentional about it. And as we move forward, as we keep showing up, we become slowly convinced more and more, slowly transformed more and more that what we say we believe, what Jesus has told us, actually is true, and it is setting us free. More and more, we will be coming to value what God values. And that treasure that we talk about, that heart that we talk about, really does move into heaven, not just in a platitude, but it really is, because it means that it is moving into God's will, God's pleasure and deepest desire and deepest purpose right here and right now. All of this begins with a choice. A choice that we have to make. We have to first realize that we do have a choice. We have to break whatever hold victimization has on us and realize, yes, I can make a different choice. I do not have to keep going along with the programs that have been installed in me or the powers that have formed around me. I have a choice. I'm not a victim anymore. I'm not passive. And that choice is all going to happen right here and right now. It is never deferred, or it is not a choice. If you're waiting for something, you're not living in kingdom. First thing Jesus says in Mark 1:15, the waiting is over. The kingdom is here. The kingdom is now. There is no more waiting. There's no more waiting or asking for God to act unilaterally in our lives as if we're just potted plants. We're just passive here. We just set a course and go. And then We set a different course and go revise as needed if the course didn't go so well. Guess what? There's no demerits for revising your course, no matter how many times you want to do it. No demerits. We learn each time we revise. We learn each time we set a new course. And what we will realize more and more and more that God has already made his choice. From the very beginning, he made his choice about us. It was in our favor. He chose us. He chose everything for us. There is nothing left for God to choose. There is nothing left for us to ask for. God has already made his choice. Now, it's our turn. What are we going to do? Right now, let's pray. Father, thank you for choosing us. How can we say it any other way? Thank you for choosing us. Thank you for the indescribable love that choice represents. To choose us, sight unseen, to choose us no matter what, to keep on choosing us, no matter what we do or how unlovely we live. That's a miracle. That's something we really can't get our minds and hearts around. But the truth is that we will never know about that love or ever experience it as real until we choose you back. It really is our turn. Father, help us to do that. Help us to choose you back. Help us to choose love. And help us to choose everything that we need to do along the path to getting to the point where we can begin to say that 51% of the time we live in kingdom. More often than not, we are here, now, present, clear enough to keep choosing what love requires for everyone concerned. That's our hope and that's our prayer, Father. Help us overcome any of the resistance, passive, aggressive, or otherwise, that would keep us from choosing you. And never let us forget, we can only love because you loved us first. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.